Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining this week is Blair Horner. I love Blair Horner. He's now the executive director, the head man of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG, as well as its chief lobbyist. Congratulations, Blair, I think, and welcome back.
Yeah, I feel like I had to run through a gauntlet to get here. So, yes, thank you, and it's great to be here.
So now, tell us about the Buffalo Billions. I'm so interested in this. This thing seems to be unraveling. Okay, I'll admit it, if I have a hero, a contemporary hero, it's Preet Bharara, you know, who is the U.S. attorney, but who has really been moving the lines of the argument as to what constitutes unfair use of office. Is that a fair?
Yeah, I think that's about right. I mean, he, for the first time in certainly modern New York history, there is somebody calling balls and strikes when it comes to what's appropriate politics and what is unethical. And he's looking, as you mentioned, at the governor's economic development plan, the so-called Buffalo Billion, and he's looking at the way contracts were let. Now, we don't know anything, really, other than the media reports, right? So it's always hard to know exactly what he's looking at. Apparently, subpoenas have been issued, according to the New York Times. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they'll find anything wrong. They're just looking at the contracting process. That being said, usually, you know, if there's smoke, doesn't necessarily mean there's fire. But if there's smoke, you want to look, right, to make sure there's no fire. And I think under the best interpretation of what the U.S. attorney is doing from the governor's perspective, anyway, the best, is he's looking to see why there's smoke. There's been a lot of controversy over the failure of the various entities that are involved in this economic development project. The governor's created not-for-profit corporation known as Fort Schuyler Association, I believe is the last part of the name, and to sort of figure out how the economic development will occur in Buffalo. And it's outside of the normal government procurement process. They've been very loath to tell anyone what they're doing. There's been an investigation out there by the Investigative Post, which is a Buffalo-based news media outlet, and they've had a hard time getting any information. And this is the public's money. So all of that put together has, you know, gotten Preet Bharara's attention. Where it goes, who knows?
Weren't you at some point, Blair, hired by the Attorney General then to make sure this was the most easy-to-read government of all times, and now it is anything but that?
Well, funny you should mention that.
What did you do while you were there?
That's right. I pulled the curtains up and they went back down again. The project I worked on when I was with then Attorney General Project Sunlight was the then Attorney General's effort to allow the public to have easy access to looking at government contracts, campaign contributions, legislation, then member items, the various charities. You could look and go in one handy dandy place. At the time, it was called sunlight.com. It's now in the new attorney general's office. The now attorney general is not so new anymore. It's called NY Open Government, and you can get access to the same information. So, yes, it was an attempt to look at to helping the public to connect the dots, to give the 19 million New Yorkers the opportunity to eyeball their own government to see if there was anything happening that they might have concerns about. And when he became governor, this governor is developing a reputation for, when it comes to openness, of being interested in giving the public easier access to government databases. So there's a new government portal where you can get access to government databases. But he has sort of the time-honored administrative position, executive branch position, of not wanting to have the public seeing how the process... How the sausage is made. You can get to see whether or not the sausage is a hologram or real through the databases, but you can't see how they actually make it, or he doesn't want you to see that.
So Preet Bharara has a concern, obviously, although he doesn't talk about it anymore. He was once admonished for saying too much by the courts, so he's more quiet about it. But he's concerned about how contracts are let. So if, in fact, you want somebody who has given you a great deal of money in your gubernatorial campaign, almost $100,000, I think, and you want him to have the contract. You draw it so only he can have contract.
That's right. And when they got caught on that, I mean, the contract, without getting into too much detail on this because I'm not an expert in it, but apparently the original version of the proposal to allow some development going on in the city of Buffalo was designed in such a way that you had to have a 50-year track record in this particular area.
And there was only one.
And there was only one company that just happened to be the one that made the campaign contributions. And when caught on that, they said, oh, that's a typo. We really meant 15.
That's a riot.
But that developer is the one who got the contract anyway, even under the 15-year standard. And as far as I know, as a reputable developer, it's not somebody who just showed up out of nowhere, but it is smoke, right?
Well, this is where Berar is getting interesting, because obviously if you ask the legislature to make rules considering their own ethical behavior, they're going to make rules which help them. So Berar is sitting on a different level. He's on the federal level, and he's taking a look down at this, and he is moving the lines, expanding the lines for accountability. Now, Joe Bruno was put through the gauntlet, but in the end, he was exonerated for having done much of this theft of honest services stuff, which we keep hearing about. So do we have any reason to believe that Berar may have potential cases here?
Well, it's hard to know when it comes to the Buffalo Billion, because we would have to know something that we're not supposed to know in the first place. All we know is what's showing up in the New York Times and other media outlets. The Buffalo News has been following this relatively closely. I mean, there's a lot of news reports and apparent clarity that there have been grand jury subpoenas issued about these contracting, but it doesn't necessarily mean anything bad happened. Now, is Berara as serious as a heart attack for these guys? Oh, yeah, definitely. Ask former Speaker Sheldon Silver and former Senate Majority Leader Dean Skelos. Those guys are in the crosshairs big time. Now, again, they're both innocent until proven guilty.
But they're both standing trial.
They'll be facing trial starting next month. November will be a big month in New York State political history. Now, what's going on in Buffalo? Who knows, right? I mean, we don't know. And the governor, to some extent, has created his own smoke by having such a closed process when it comes to contracts. And it's not just here. I mean, the Tappan Zee Bridge, for example, the new Tappan Zee Bridge, we still don't have a financial plan. We don't know how much the tolls are going to go up. That kind of stuff still isn't out there, right? So the governor likes to keep this stuff as close to the vest as possible. He doesn't want to, I assume, give his opponents a target to attack him on. But when he does that, he could inevitably be drawing attention to a process that maybe is fine, where the U.S. attorney's looking. And Berara, I don't know if he's expanding the lines. I think Berara is setting the lines for what is appropriate and what is inappropriate conduct. And until that has happened, no one ever drew the lines. It was just sort of fuzziness, sort of a vague sense that, you know, if you got caught, it was bad. If you didn't, it was fine.
So if you got your son-in-law a job, business as usual in the old days. Now, not so much.
That's right. That's right. If you're abusing your public office when you do it, at least as the U.S. attorney sees it, you got a world of trouble. Former Senator, Deputy Senate Majority Leader Tom Libous is facing prison time for engineering a job for his son and apparently abusing his public office, using his public powers to enrich his son. And that is a no-no. And Senator Libous now is facing time in the slammer as a result of that.
Well, and not only him, but Dean Skelos.
He's not been convicted yet, though.
No, Libous was convicted. Oh, I see your point. Yeah,
So Libous is being measured for the orange jumpsuit. Skelos is still thinking about it.
Very good point. Okay, so now all the headlines are suggesting that Governor Cuomo, whose popularity is, decreasing, has decided to make a philosophical turn left. Is that warranted? I mean, in your opinion, Blair Horner of NYPIRG, do you think that that's really what's happening?
Well, that he's moving to the left?
Yes.
I think the governor, meaning, again, I'm not a Democratic activist. I'm not enrolled in the Democratic Party. NYPIRG is strictly nonpartisan. But, I can open my eyeballs and see. And it seems more like the governor is zigzagging from a centrist position to the left position to adopt as many of the liberal sort of base of the Democratic Party positions so that he can be viewed enough as a champion to forestall any potential serious threat from the left. I think I assume they did not calculate the Zephyr Teachout phenomena in the last primary, and that sort of, I'm sure, shook them up. Anyway, when you govern for a long time, people get sick of you. I mean, you know, ask his father, right? I mean,
ask him. He told me that early in the game.
It's one of those things. If you wear out, you're welcome. As Mario Cuomo once said, in politics, friends are fleeting and enemies accumulate. And so the longer you're in office, the more that happens, right? So the governor's facing those kinds of things. And I think it's more of a zigzag, sort of a tactical approach to reminding people that he is a Democrat, even though he has to make sure that the budget gets balanced and he has to sort of keep the books in order.
Well, if he really was tacking left, as they say in sailing, don't you know? If he was really
zigzagging, if he was really it's not the same as tacking.
Tacking left, if he was really going that way, then you would think that he would want a Democratic Senate so that he could get his proposal passed. However, I guess we all sort of accept the fact that he didn't want a Democratic Senate, that he said he did, but he didn't, and he didn't help them get elected, and they lost. What would happen, Blair Horner, if the Senate went Democratic? Now you'd have a Democratic Assembly who say they want stuff, left stuff, and you'd have a Democratic Senate who would. That would put tremendous pressure on a governor to say, hey, whoa, don't build a big swimming pool right down the center of the state.
Right. I mean, every Northeast governor, in my opinion, sort of governs from a moderate center.
Sure.
They have to not only, you know, appease the, you know, infinite demands from the public, they have to make sure that all whatever happens, happens with the finite set of resources. And at a certain level, that sort of tacks you to the middle. The populations in the Northeast tend to be more socially liberal. They also know that the bills have to be paid. I mean, you get outside of the city of New York, for example, it's a purple state in New York. It's not a blue state. And so, you know, those are the competing pressures. If there's a Democratic Senate and a Democratic Assembly, the governor would end up being the bad guy because he's the guy who has to come in and tell the legislature, well, sorry, we can't spend the money on that. We don't have the money for it. And the legislature would be just as happy to throw the blame on him than for them to take the blame from the groups to get them elected. So I think the governor would be under a lot of pressure, and that is to some extent why, as a Queens Democrat, he's not part of the most liberal wing of the party. He understands the need for balance. Now, that being said, the Democrats did control the Senate once already.
And they made fools of themselves.
And it was a mess. And they didn't have sort of they were not ready for showtime.
They fought with each other.
That's right.
It wasn't nice.
And they didn't have strong leadership. They didn't have really a thought through agenda. I think they were just as surprised as anyone when they took over the majority. And so, you know, they had a hard time. Now, this time around, it may not be the same way, but you certainly would be a fractured leadership, because to make the Democrats, even if they have a numerical majority, the legislative majority means that the so-called independent Democratic Conference led by Jeff Klein would have to be playing ball with the mainstream Democrats, and that's tough. On the assembly side, they still have new leadership, which has not been tested as much as the old one. So.
Yeah, don't be hasty about that. Okay, so that's for all of you who are listening who don't get that one. Hasty is the new speaker taking Sheldon Silver's.
There you go.
Sheldon Silver's place.
But I was listening, Alan.
Okay, there's a move on pushed by people like my very esteemed colleague Gerald Benjamin to have another constitutional convention, which keeps on coming up, has to come up because it's in the Constitution that so often you got to vote on it. But what has happened in the past, not to go on too long, is that the very people in the legislature who we would hope that the Constitutional Convention might rein in a little bit are the people who control the Constitutional Convention. So therefore, I'm against it. What about you?
Well, we'll have to see what happens, right? I mean, I'm an open-minded guy.
I am
an optimist by nature, or I wouldn't be doing this sort of crazy job. That being said, there's 2 years until the vote. The vote is in November 2017, and in 2 years, it's conceivable that reforms could get passed that would change the delegate selection process to make the delegates more
delegate
independent.
To the Constitutional Convention.
That's right. Yeah, just so your listeners know, in 2017, there'll be a vote by the public every 20 years, a vote by the public as to whether or not they want to have a convention. If they agree to one, then they vote on whether or not who the delegates would be. The way it's set up, there's 3 delegates per Senate district, 15 statewide. Those individuals then would convene, they'd come up with their own proposals, and those proposals, once approved by the convention, would then be voted on by the public. So the public gets 3 bites at the apple in terms of whether or not they would approve what happens. So the delegates, your point is, it would be a Paul's convention, right? It would be a convention not of the people, but of the political elite of Albany, which would get themselves elected. And there's a lot of argument that that's true, right? Who else can run? Who else can leave their jobs?
But Blair, even if they say, we're not going to run as individuals,
they have their buddies.
They have their cousin Louis. Yeah,
that's right. And, or their big contributors or the powerful interest groups that really control the process. That's all being said. I mean, you know, but there's time to try to fix the delegate selection process to make it harder for Louis and the others to be the convention.
Well, give me an example of how that could be done. How can you prevent your cousin Louis, who is not you, from running?
You can't exclude them from running. You can do things to say, such as that in terms of the votes, instead of voting for three per Senate district, which probably means one senator and two assembly members, that you only get one vote and that the top three vote-getters win. Now, that may still be the polls, because there's not a lot you can do without a constitutional change to the delegate selection process. I'm just being optimistic, Alan.
Yes, you are.
I'm not willing to throw the whole thing out the window.
I am.
With the baby and the bathwater and all together.
Gotcha. Well, so much for that. I know one of the
easily dismissed. I know Blair Horner. Next topic.
I know that you are terrific when it comes to the rights of voters. And one plan for New York State is to have the same day you can register on the same day you vote, same day voter registration. Now, obviously, the Democrats are all for this and the Republicans are not so much.
Well, the Democrats say they're for it and the Republicans say they're not. I mean, you never know. When you actually get to changing who comes to the polling places, the incumbency party is the most nervous about that because these are new people that they don't know.
Yeah, Louis the bartender might actually run against
a different Louis in this case.
A different Louis.
That's right.
Or maybe the same Louis.
Right, right. A number of states, about six states, have allowed their voters to register on Election Day and vote on Election Day. And those states tend to have the highest voter turnout. And so, you know, in a modern age where I can go into an ATM in Florence, Italy, and take out money out of my bank account.
I did that too, in Florence.
You took my money?
No, I took my money.
And so why can't you do that? Why can't you register people to vote? We have all these databases. We can prove that who they are. It could be on a paper ballot, and they get counted later. We can verify it later. Why can't you do that? In fact, six states do it. So that's the big thing that you could do to sort of break it down. New York had under 30% voter turnout in the last election. A historic low. It's pathetic. And so the fact that everyone sort of whines about it but then does nothing, I think it says terrible things about our elected leaders. This should be about making it easier for people to vote, not harder. In most of the Western democracies, you just show up and you can vote because that's part of the system. Here you have to go out and register. We don't think it should be a test to becoming a candidate, to becoming a citizen and a voting citizen in New York. You should be able to do it. Why not make it easy?
Okay.
He said. And I'm not Louis.
Are Cuomo and de Blasio, Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio ever going to... I just can't understand why Cuomo keeps picking fights with de Blasio.
Really? You can't?
Well, actually...
Take a wild guess.
I can. I just don't think it's good for him.
I don't think it's good for either one of them, frankly.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Because, I mean, the governor is in the world of these two alpha males, right?
Alpha.
He's the bigger one of the alphas, and he has the most power. And so it's not good for de Blasio, even if he looks like he's standing up for the city against the state. It's not good. The governor's polling, there's no indication that it's really been helping or anything. But institutionally, the mayor is the mayor of a very big municipality, about 8 million people. It's bigger than some states. The mayor believes they should have their own sort of executive authority to run it, just like any governor could in these little dinky states that have fewer people. The way the state is set up, the governor runs the show. And so there's been these clashes. Giuliani and Pataki, that was no pretty sight at times. Koch and Mario Cuomo, that was no pretty sight at sometimes. So, I mean, there are institutional pressures, in this case, perhaps exacerbated by sort of
personal.
The rough and tumble personal.
Now, your organization, NYPIRG, put out a report and guide for New York, New Yorkers, Energy Crossroads, New York State, Reforming the Energy Vision. What's going on there? What's that about?
Wow. Make sure all your listeners.
I have a rotator cuff problem. I just threw you a softball too hard.
Well, that shouldn't have hurt your rotator cuff. It's when you throw the hard ones. New York is actually embarking on a very interesting plan right now. The state's energy grid was built in the 20th century. They want to modernize it, a 21st century digitally based energy grid. The theory, sort of some of the backdrop of the theory is they want to move away from a small number of very large power plants that emit toxins, pollutants into the air, to a more decentralized system so you can deal with any kind of, you know, problems that may occur in the grid. It's diversified, so you still have power. You want to make it digital because people then can generate, you know, power on their rooftops and send it into the grid and still be able to get power back from the grid when they need it, when it's cloudy or the sun goes down. So in that process is playing out. We think the public should really be much more engaged in this. And so we put out a report. You're right on it. People can get it on our website, which explains it, sort of a citizen's guide. We want people to get involved. We want people to be clear to the regulators that it's not just an inside game, that the public cares and that the public wants two things to come out of this thing. One is that the grid, whatever comes out of this, is green, that it reduces fossil fuel emissions to the lowest possible levels, relies more on alternative energy, and that secondarily, it's still affordable. The worst thing in the world you could have, well, not the worst thing, but a terrible thing would be if the poor who can't afford solar panels on their apartment buildings end up subsidizing the solar roofs of middle-income or upper-middle-income people. And so it has to be an affordable plan, it has to be a green plan, and it has to be a smart plan. And so the Public Service Commission is going through the process right now, which could be a revolutionary change in the state's energy system, and we think the public should be part of it.
And Blair, you're an expert on who the lobbyists are, who the contributors are. Who are the players in something like this? In other words, who's likely to have an oar in the water?
Well, environmentalists, for sure, just the way I was describing it. Consumer groups, for sure. The utility companies, for sure, because whatever rules come out, they're going to have to live with.
Well, but
the power producers.
We're talking with you guys, the goo-goo groups, as we say, that's a pimple compared to the power of the utility.
Well, I was working my way up. You know, it's like the elephant. You know, I'm the blind man with the elephant.
Sure.
I was starting on the
Absolutely.
Toe. Absolutely. The utility companies are major players. They care because they got to live with the rules. The fossil fuel industry, the people that produce the power, they're going to care. The business community is going to care. Because to some extent they produce some of the power. So you have a lot of the major players are involved in this issue. I think the Public Service Commission, to its credit, has been trying as best as it can to sort of corral and find common ground and all that. And all we're trying to do is make sure the public's part of that discussion.
Well, you know, my phone rings at home all the time, albeit I live in Massachusetts, and there's always somebody on the other phone who wants me to get off of, you know, the plan we have and to go on some other verschlugene plan. I don't know whether or not, I never know whether this is credulous or not.
Yeah, and there have been controversies around these what are called ESCOs as to whether or not they deliver the product and have the sort of institutional wherewithal to make sure you get your power when you need it. And in our report, we sort of lay out ways that the consumer can be more involved in the Public Service Commission processes in the future to make sure that's the case. One of the things we call for, AARP is very involved in this as well, is to create sort of an independent consumer advocate office that would have the resources to weigh in on behalf of the public before the Public Service Commission. I mean, the Public Service Commission really has a dual role. One is to make sure that people can get the energy that they need, but also to make sure that the utility companies and the other energy producers don't go out of business. We think that there needs to be a clear advocate on behalf of consumers to look out for the issues of where you, for example, you were talking about. And we also think that as if in a decentralized system, like what New York did with the when it created its health exchange for Obamacare, there were a lot of different plans. You could go to one portal and do straight up comparisons, apples to apples, oranges to oranges. We think something like that should be created as well in terms of the future of energy production in New York.
And even that is complicated enough. Well,
sure.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. Our guest has been the incredible Blair Horner, now the executive director, the head man of New York Public Interest Research Group. Congratulations again, Blair, and thanks so much for joining us. You're getting busier and busier all the time. We can't find you when we need you.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.